begin with introductions from the court. I'm Mike Havikin, the Chief Justice, and now, by order of seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller-Lerman.
William Castle. Good morning.
Stephanie Stacy. Good morning.
Good morning. I am Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Paffick. Good morning.
So John Freidenberg. Good morning.
Thank you, members of the court. First case for today is State versus Miranda. Counsel, you may take your places at counsel table. And is it Mr. Malia?
Yes,
sir. Good morning to you. You may approach and you may proceed. And it's my understanding, before you get started, it's my understanding that both sides have up to 20 minutes to argue if you care to. Do either counsel have any questions?
No, Your Honor.
With that, Mr. Malia, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Kyle Malia, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Marlon Miranda. In this case, he was sentenced or convicted of murder in the first degree and use of a firearm to commit that felony. He was sentenced in the lower court to life imprisonment on count one and 45 to 50 years consecutive on count two. Based on the arguments in my brief and the arguments today, I'm arguing that this court should overturn the verdict of the lower court and remand this back for a new trial. And unless there are questions, I plan to focus majority on my argument today on trial counsel's performance, specifically during voir dire and how he was deficient and prejudiced the defendant there. At trial, Mr. Miranda was denied effective representation during the trial, specifically beginning in voir dire and jury selection. The purpose of the voir dire in any criminal trial is to ensure that the jury and the defendant is given an opportunity to find a jury and ask them questions to maintain that they are free from bias, free from prejudice, and that he gets a fair trial. It is the opportunity for the defendant to question the jury specifically to uncover these issues and determine if that specific jury member is fit for this jury service. Mr. Miranda was denied that opportunity. Trial counsel.
What specifically happened? What did trial counsel do? Did they ask any questions, or did he ask any questions?
Well, Your Honor, the voir dire started with the state, and the county attorney asked several questions, went on for a very extensive period of time. There were several, I believe it was three members of the jury panel that went back for a private voir dire. Trial counsel did ask questions of those members. All of the private voir dire, all of those jury members were struck for cause outside the presence of the rest of the jury. During trial counsel's very short, very limited, what I called in my brief, a pre-opening statement, to the panel, he asked three rhetorical questions. In the Bill of Exceptions, as the court will see, there were no individualized questions. He didn't ask any questions specifically about the facts of the case, about the individual predispositions of the jurors, of the potential jurors. And what he did was give a statement where he specifically, on no less than five occasions, told the jury he did not want to be there. He told the jury that his main goal was to end the trial as quickly as possible and make it as easy as possible for them. And so what I'm saying is that he didn't even participate in voir dire. Trial counsel spent the majority of his time complaining about an injury that he had, complaining about why they were so close to Christmas, and that none of it was his fault. He specifically, in quoting, he told the jury, hell, I don't want to be here either. He told the jury, based on his injury, that he was in as bad of a position as the jury was to be in the jury pool. And that, I maintain, is he told the jury that the trial was a mere formality, that going through the process is just a process that they have to get through, and at the end of this, the jury can find him guilty, and we'll all go home before Christmas.
Would that have been a strategy on the part of the defense attorney?
If it is a strategy, it is an unreasonable one. I don't believe any reasonably competent attorney, any reasonably trained attorney has the ability to tell the jury, we're just going through the process, tells the jury that they don't actually want to be there for the trial. And any strategy that this could be is patently unreasonable. The county attorney spent approximately 175 pages of the Bill of Exception asking questions, inquiring of the jury, finding out if they were fit for service on that particular case. Trial counsel spent 8 pages.
Counsel,
yes,
as I recall in reading your brief, particularly in the assignment of error, but even in the argument on this issue, I don't recall reading any suggestion of any question or any topic for voir dire that your brief maintained was not asked. Did I miss it?
No. Generally, this court has held that when questioning the effective assistance of counsel during voir dire, specifically what questions and what topics and which jurors by name or by number have to be asked.
Which is all to what avail. It may have been fleeting, but was it harmful?
Yes. To answer Justice Castle's question, to finish, Justice Miller-Learman, is here we can't say what specific questions or topics needed to be asked because all of them weren't asked. There was no questions about the pretrial publicity that happened. There was no questions about any predispositions based on him being in custody, any questions about him being of Hispanic descent. There are none of the questions that an ordinary attorney would, or topics.
Many of those have been redundant since the county attorney fairly exhaustively asked.
No, I don't believe so. I believe that all of us have seen a voir dire. All of us have read voir dire. Voir dires are uncomfortable positions for jurors. Most jurors, in my experience, in all of our experience, is that they don't want to open up. And while the first question might be fleeting and the second question might be fleeting, the third and fourth questions by the defense counsel, after they've warmed up, after they've spent several hours after the state, that in my experience, in most reasonable trial attorneys' experience, that is when they start to get and tell you what they truly believe. And more information for a practitioner at that point is always, always needed. Jury voir dire is usually never enough time to figure out everything inside of a person's head. And to answer your question, I think, Ms. Justice Miller-Learman, is Mr. Miranda was prejudiced here because from the word go, trial counsel did not effectively, adequately test the state's case. From the word go, he did not participate in a fundamental portion of a trial. And under the Strickland standard, the prejudice prong can be met by either showing that the reasonable probability, or as this court has said, if a defendant is denied counsel during a critical stage, which it is undisputed that voir dire is a critical stage of a trial process, if they are denied attorney, this court can presume that he was prejudiced. And in this case, in this instant, when trial counsel did not ask any questions, did not inquire of the jury, and in fact went further and told them he didn't want to be there, told them that his main goal was not to test the state's case, was not to present evidence. His main goal was the comfort of the jurors.
Do you have authority, and remind me if you do, of why prejudice would be presumed in that scenario?
I believe it is State v. Canvas. I cited it in my brief. It's that when the adversarial process is so fundamentally and functionally abandoned that we can presume the prejudice. That's what this court, I believe,
so
is the Supreme
Court. I mean, the universe of presumed prejudice is pretty small in Strickland.
Yes, I would agree that it is very small. It's a very hard thing to get to. If a trial attorney just disappears for 3 days of the trial, I think this court would say that would be abandoning him. And what I am arguing is that this is functionally the same thing. That when trial counsel fails in their duty, fails in their ability, fails to represent the appellant or a defendant in any case to this level, that is functionally the same thing as him not being there. And in fact, in this case, had trial counsel simply said pass for cause and not done anything else, He would have left Mr. Miranda in a better position because he wouldn't have told him that he didn't want to be there. He wouldn't have informed the jury and the subtext that this is just a formality and we're just going through the motions to get to the jury verdict and get to Christmas. His actions went so far beyond that, and that it is, I find it offensive that this trial counsel told the jury he didn't want to be there. I would suggest to the court that it should be.
What are we to make of the fact that the trial counsel was apparently extremely experienced in years and years and years of defense work?
And his experience and his years of defense work, sometimes that helps. Sometimes people get tired and sometimes they stop trying. And in this case, he told the jury that he doesn't even try to figure out what's in a juror's head anymore. He doesn't even try during voir dire. He doesn't try to accomplish the mission of a jury process. He doesn't try to accomplish the mission of the voir dire to find a fair and impartial jury.
If that is prejudicial, can that be cured by cross-examination, presenting evidence, things of that nature by defense counsel? Or is it it's happened, it's done, you can't fix it?
I don't think once you get to that process after you've gone through the jury selection, I think the entire jury panel is tainted at that point. Once he's told the jury that he doesn't want to be there and that this is a formality and that we're just going through the motions, I don't think there's an instruction. I don't think that there's a question. I don't think there's anything else after that point that can cure with this jury. Once that cat is out of the bag, it's out of the bag. And I think the only remedy there is for a new trial and a new jury panel, free from all of these issues, free from all of this information, free from the error that I believe trial counsel committed here.
Counsel, in response to my earlier question, you mentioned, I think, three potential topics of inquiry. But I don't recall, certainly not in your assignment of error, none of those appeared in your assignment of error, and I don't remember any of those three appearing in the argument section of your brief. Do you agree that that is an accurate characterization?
I would agree that I did not name those three topics, yes, Your Honor.
Or any other topics.
Or any other topics. What I argued in my brief is that all topics, all of the potential avenues, and that...
Why couldn't a long-experienced trial attorney who was there and sized up the jurors during the course of an extremely extensive voir dire by the state make a judgment about the character and qualifications of the jurors in front of him and make a strategic decision to just try to be friendly with them, to sympathize with them, to empathize with them, and not to ask questions that may make things worse?
Not asking questions to make things worse could be a reasonable strategic decision.
So the prejudice we can't presume, can we?
The problem here is that that's not what trial counsel did.
Well, how do we know that?
Because he told us, Your Honor, in what he told the jury is that he doesn't even try during voir dire anymore to figure out what the jury's saying. He said, I don't try to figure out what you all are thinking anymore. And by his own statements during voir dire, trial counsel has abdicated his duty to Mr. Miranda.
That's the heart of your argument.
Yes, Your Honor. That is the heart of the argument, and that is, I think, the part here. And had trial counsel stood up, given a speech and said, I pass for cause, and not told the jury that he didn't want to be there, not told the jury that he was in pain, not told the jury not to blame him for trial next to Christmas, not told the jury that his main goal was to get the trial done before the 12-day break before Christmas. Had he not done all of the things to harm Mr. Miranda's case, harm the appellant's case, that could possibly be a strategic decision. The what he did, though, is patently unreasonable, in my opinion. And that's my argument to the court, is that because of his statements, because of his actions during voir dire.
I don't want to, your time is dwindling, and I don't want to take your time, but you mentioned at the outset you were going to concentrate on the assignments of ineffective assistance of trial counsel. Are you, in effect, conceding that there was sufficient evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the state to support the conviction?
No, I am not conceding that part.
And how do you suggest, I gather from your brief that you are attempting to induce us to return to at least some variety of the accused rule or to treat circumstantial evidence as less valid than direct evidence. Am I misreading your brief?
If that was the implication that the court took, that was not my intention. I'm not asking the court to overrule its precedent. I don't believe that there's cause at this point to address any of the precedent before the court. And so with the evidence presented, I believe, based on the evidence from the state's witnesses and from Mr. Miranda testifying, that there is no direct evidence of purposeful premeditation, deliberate premeditation in this case.
Aren't you asking us to reweigh the evidence, particularly your client's testimony?
I don't believe I'm asking the court to reweigh the evidence. What I'm asking the court to do is look at the evidence, and that even in the light most favorable to the state, I believe the overwhelming contradictory evidence is that he did not act purposefully, with premeditation. It was not a deliberate, intentional action at that point to commit the crime of first-degree murder.
Didn't he, after he was excluded from the bar, go back to his car, retrieve the gun, and come looking?
And I believe the evidence was that he came to speak with his ex-wife or estranged wife to discuss issues. The evidence also was that the decedent here had made threats, and there was, if I'm remembering correctly, multiple witnesses who stated that he pushed the estranged wife out of the way and took an aggressive stance with Mr. Miranda, and at that point, that is when, and I think based upon all that evidence, there is enough to say that a reasonable jury could not find him guilty of first degree.
Did he shoot Mr. Miranda in the back?
And you'll have to forgive
me. Not Mr. Miranda.
Did Mr. Miranda shoot the decedent in the back? You'll have to forgive me. I believe it was the first shot was to the front torso, but I will defer to what's in the Bill of Exceptions. Again, I did not do this trial, and so I don't remember it firsthand. I'm remembering what I've read multiple times in the Bill of Exceptions. I believe, and if the Bill of Exceptions is different, I'll defer, obviously, to the facts or the words on the page. But what I'm...
You're not saying the decedent came and sought out the defendant or the appellant, are you?
No, that's not the evidence at all at the trial. The evidence was that Mr. Miranda did return to the scene.
And with the gun.
Yes.
And
followed them up the street.
That would be the evidence, yes.
Pulled the gun.
So the evidence there, I believe, was that the gun was not pulled until after the confrontation with the decedent.
Well, there were some indications, people yelling, he has a gun. That would allude that happened before the altercation occurred, wouldn't it?
Yes.
So then the victim moves Mr. Miranda's wife out of the way and takes a defensive stance or an aggressive stance. That would be second-degree murder, or would it be manslaughter? We're talking about self-defense?
I mean, I believe it's probably a manslaughter in that case.
Sudden quarrel?
Yes. And that was also part of the issues that we had in this case was with the ineffective portion is that during the beginning of the case, the questions and all of the strategy from trial counsel was a self-defense, and then in the end of the case...
He took a gun to a fist fight and it's self-defense?
Well, the testimony was that the decedent did threaten Mr. Miranda's life prior to that, and that Mr. Miranda was not from Omaha, believes that Omaha is a dangerous place, believes that it is... it was necessary for protection of himself from not just the people around the bar that he knew, but other people that he did not know.
So self-defense was a reasonable strategy.
Yeah, yes, self-defense would have been a reasonable strategy, but trial counsel switched halfway through. And so part of the trial, he spent most of it with attempting to do a self-defense, and another portion of the trial he tried to do mitigating it to manslaughter and a death happening upon a sudden quarrel. And in that situation, without discussing it, and I understand that is not in the record, discussing the strategy, that is put the jury in a position where they couldn't figure out what to believe or which way to go. And based on that, I believe the strategy there was also deficient. That is all of my time. Thank you. I would ask the court to overturn these arguments based upon the argument and the brief today.
Thank you very much. Ms. Tangeman, good morning to you.
May it please the court, I'm Erin Tangeman, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Nebraska. I will begin where my opposing counsel left off with sufficiency of the evidence. The state submits that the evidence overwhelmingly established that Miranda committed first-degree murder and use of a deadly weapon. The only evidence of threats from the victim or that the victim squared toward the defendant and pushed Sharon out of the way come from Miranda. That is not what the state's evidence was at trial, and the state presented numerous witness testimony from unrelated witnesses who had no connection to the defendant, the victim, the defendant's wife. The evidence showed that the victim was gunned down by Miranda in front of numerous eyewitnesses, and those witnesses testified that Miranda quickly approached Sharon and Jose. He pulled out a gun. He reached around Sharon and shot Jose. Jose fell to the ground. Miranda then pushed Sharon out of the way, pushed her to the ground, stood over Jose, and fired more shots into his body. Jose was shot 6 times, once in the hand, once in the neck, and 4 times in the torso. After shooting Jose, Miranda then drug Sharon down the sidewalk and began slamming her against a brick wall while he was still holding his gun. After Miranda was apprehended by police, he was heard saying something to the effect of, "The guy got too close to my wife, so he got shot." This was a premeduitated murder, and the evidence deduced at trial established that.
Let me see if I can't clarify something we were asking with opposing counsel. So to the extent what happened in the bar may have been a quarrel, legally speaking, right, it's over.
Agreed. I think the state's position is that it would maybe not legally be speaking a quarrel because the evidence presented was that the victim was just sitting there. Miranda came up and punched him, took him to the ground. The victim did not fight back. The victim was calm after, kind of shocked by the whole thing. This was all provoked by Miranda. Miranda was the instigator in the fight. The victim did not fight back at that time.
So the state's argument is the subsequent episode is premeditated, however brief.
However brief.
Thank you.
Yes.
The jury in this case was instructed on lesser included offenses.
Yes.
And rejected those.
Yes. Sudden quarrel, manslaughter was given as an instruction as well as self-defense. So they had both of those, and defense counsel did argue both of them to the jury in closing.
Thank you.
And there are no assignments of error regarding instruction.
Correct.
As the defense counsel's efforts in voir dire?
Yes. So I do agree, as we argued in our brief, as Justice Castle has pointed out, that Miranda failed to specifically detail his allegation of deficient performance. There's no specificity in the assignment of error itself, and in the argument portion, he doesn't identify what questions should have been asked by counsel, what information counsel should have presented to the jury. I do think if this court finds that The deficient performance allegation has been specifically raised to this court. I do think there's an argument this was a reasonable strategic decision by counsel. Opposing counsel spent a lot of time talking about the statement that defense counsel made that he didn't want to be there. But that statement has to be taken into context. He was talking at that time about everyone having a right to a trial, a right to a jury trial, and told the jury that he appreciates that they were there today. And for those of them who did not want to be there today, he didn't want to be there either, but we're here, we have this constitutional right. So he was trying to build rapport with the jury. He was trying to reach some common ground with the jury right before he started his presentation, questions to the jury. We had numerous juries inform the court of, I've got plans, I'm going on vacation, I can't leave my job. As he mentioned to the jury itself, I've been sitting here and I think everyone is fair and impartial, and the most problems I see with this jury is time commitments, other commitments, thing like that. So I think what he was trying to do is, hey, don't hold this against us. I know we're getting close to Christmas. I know this is going to take over a week, but I don't want to be here either. I think that's a strategic decision, and I do not think that's an effective assistance of counsel. Regarding his comments of his leg pain and things of that nature, he was just explaining to the jury that he was in physical pain, and if they saw him grimacing, that's why he didn't want them to take that in a negative way to what they were doing, anything in that process. So I did not see any issues there. So that is the state's position, that voir dire by trial counsel was not ineffective, and I think if you find the assignment of error has been properly alleged, that you can reject the claim on the merits.
Does the state think that any of the ineffective assistance of counsel assignments of error are adequately assigned?
Well, I will say, so I came into this case a little late simply because someone left our office. And I do agree with the majority of the positions taken in her brief. But I do think there are some arguments, especially assignment of error 6. I do not think that that was sufficiently alleged. We just have a conclusion of zealous advocacy in the assignment of error. I do not think that was proper. As for assignment of error 5, the reviewing of discovery and failing to file pretrial motions, we argued in brief, and I would agree that the pretrial motions has not been adequately stated to this court. We don't know what type of motions. His argument just says motion to suppress, but he doesn't give any grounds. Regarding the failure to review discovery, this court has found at least a couple of times, I found in my research, that that claim is not appropriate for review on direct appeal and should be found to be record insufficient is what I'm trying to say. I do think in this case, though, given the overwhelming facts of the case, the state would also pitch that he can't show prejudice because of the overwhelming evidence of guilt. There's nothing that reviewing the discovery would have done, especially since Miranda himself testified at trial. And then the only claim that I'm not certain on is assignment of error 3. We took the position that the record is not sufficient to address the plea negotiations. I do think, there's nothing in the record regarding plea negotiations, so we obviously have nothing on that, but I do agree that the claim is pretty vague. It doesn't say if he asked his counsel to conduct plea negotiations. It doesn't say if the state would have been willing to conduct plea negotiations. So that is
a bigger picture of things. If our case law takes the position that every time someone says, well, I wasn't informed about plea agreements, that means everybody gets some post-conviction opportunity to have a hearing of some kind. Is there something flawed with that philosophy?
Well, yeah, I think, the purpose of this is to actually talk to the defendant and figure out what went on, and so you can make actual claims that have at least some potential merit and not just throw out, well, he should have done this. You know, when you do get to post-conviction, they are going to have to show that they would have taken a plea, things like that, so there is a little bit more. But I do agree, and I think maybe this court has even said before that there needs to be more alleged factually regarding whether or not, I guess it's more, I think there was a 1987 case that said claiming ineffective assistance of counsel because counsel failed to obtain plea negotiations, defendant must establish facts that would establish the plea negotiation was reasonably possible. And I think that was recently cited in the Court of Appeals. That's where I saw that case. So I guess it's up to this court. We took the position in our brief that the record is not sufficient to address the claim. And then the only...
I beg your pardon. On that one, on informed about a plea?
Yes.
Is that a constitutional right to be informed about a plea?
Yes. And his allegations are not that he was not informed of a plea, but that my counsel should have done something to get into plea negotiations with the state.
Because it's constitutional because it's framed as ineffective counsel.
Yes. I believe there's case law out there that if the state gives a plea offer to defense counsel, if defense counsel does not present that plea offer to the defendant,
but
then yes.
It is in the constitutional pigeonhole of ineffective counsel.
Yes.
That's how we get to the substance of a plea communicated or not.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. The only one other thing I would like to point out is on assignment of error 5, his assignment of error did address two parts, the reviewing of discovery and the pretrial motions, but his argument contained numerous more claims about failure to take certain depositions, continuances, trial strategy, and I would just note that none of those were asserted in the assignment of error.
And on the plea negotiations, the specific assignment of error was never seeking out plea negotiations with the state. There was no assignment that there had been some plea offer communicated to the defense counsel that was not communicated to the defendant.
Correct. And his argument was similar to that as well.
Thank you.
Unless this court has any further questions, we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. Counsel, thank you very much. That concludes arguments in State versus Miranda. And you are excused, counsel. And the next case of the day, then, is State versus Sullivan.